Hello. In this audio snippet, we would like to continue talking about the post-Civil War period in America and how the seeds of the decline continue to be sown. And we would like to talk a little bit about the presidency of Rutherford B. Hayes. But before we get to that, we'd like to share some preliminary thoughts that might not be directly related to the topic, but we believe are worth mentioning. And we'll try to do it quickly and then try to get to Rutherford Hayes. The first thing is that after the previous recording, I kept thinking to myself, why was I using the word sandpit when referring to the sandpit of common sense? Because the word in my head that I wanted to get out was sand trap, and I kept thinking of this the sand traps that you see in golf courses when you hit a ball and it falls into the sand trap, and it's kind of difficult. Takes a little bit of skill to successfully get the ball out of the sand trap and back, let's say, onto the green, because usually these sand traps are near the green, where the hole is, and as golfers try to aim for the green, if they aim incorrectly, they end up in the sand traps, and that's sort of similar to the problem with common sense, that it's like the green refers to the truth, the actual fuller truth. And people may be aiming for the truth. They have the intention of hitting the green of the truth. But if they are off a little bit, they end up with the ball in one of those sand traps. So they have the green right next door, you could say, to the sand trap, but they're not there. They're trapped in some falsehood, and that's what happens to conservatives. They aim for the truth in some generic way, but they become satisfied with a more simplistic version of it. And anything that oversimplifies the truth ends up being falsehood because it's not the real truth. And even though it may have shades of the truth, eventually, if it's taken to be the truth, it has a vacuum of truth in it that is filled eventually by falsehood. And that's kind of what happens a lot with common sense. When you rely too much on it, then it becomes a sand trap in that sense. And that's why I kept wanting to say the word sand trap, but for some reason I kept saying sandpit and sandpit over and over again. And I asked myself afterwards, why was that? And as you may know, a sandpit or sandbox, as they're known more commonly in the U.S., are these little like playpens or these boxes filled with sand that are on children's playgrounds, where children sit there and start playing with the sand and so forth. So it basically points to someone who has stayed immature, and someone who has stayed a child and is playing in the sand pit all the time and has refused to grow up and become an adult with regard to the truth. So they stay like children, and that's kind of what has happened to the country. We have become permanently adolescent. It's as if we reached the age of 19, the teenage years, but we never went into 20. And we never matured into adulthood. We never, as a country, came out of adolescence to become a grown-up country and begin to fulfill our calling, our destiny, our full and true destiny. Because conservatives think that we already achieved that destiny, And we were kind of getting there, but we were not there yet. We had not crossed the Jordan, figuratively speaking. And that's what happened. We thought as a country that we had made it, but we were not there yet. And we refused to grow out of our adolescence, a certain adolescence or teenage behavior that was seen even from the beginning when we acted like petty little children, 13 colonies fighting for individual sovereignty. We didn't want to be controlled by this big central government because that was going to be the monarchy all over again. And that system of federalism just opened the door for a lot of other things. Instead of dealing with the root issues, federalism became this half-concocted mechanism to protect interests and to supposedly protect us against tyranny, when what we really needed was a system, internal system of protection against tyranny, instead of artificially just saying, well, we'll just not let the federal government tyrannize us. But that didn't stop us from letting the local governments, the state and local governments, tyrannizing over us. And if you have any doubts about that, just ask the black people of the period, you know, back in the earlier days of the country, when black people in the South, you know, were treated like dirt, that their human rights were violated because there was a tyranny, a state tyranny that could not be controlled or limited by the bigger federal government, because we wanted to prevent the country becoming tyrannized by this centralized monarchy. This faraway monarchy, just as in the old days, there was this monarchy that was thousands of miles away on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, and the federal government became sort of a kind of a reflection of that in people's minds, and they said, we don't want the tyranny from Washington. But they didn't put in, instead of dealing with the root of the problem and creating a system where any form of government cannot tyrannize the individual. Instead of that, we just said, well, just not let ourselves be tyrannized by a government that is far, far away. So we'll just let ourselves be tyrannized by the state government. So it was all this artificial, childish behavior. And we never grew up to be an adult nation, a real adult nation. We still don't have a real central bank like any formal grown-up nation would have. We don't have a national ID system like even third world countries have. That at least we're not hampered by the limitations that we have had. In that regard, they were limited. They're limited in other regards, obviously, but even they understand we need a national ID system. We never had that. And those are symptoms of just this perennial teenagehood, shall we say, perennial adolescence that we as a country just chose never to get out of. So we ended up dying. We're about to die. We're, shall we say, but less than 2 months away from the country being dead, and we're dying at the figurative age of 19. That's why it's not a coincidence that prior to our death, the number 19 became so relevant. I mean, I don't think the number 19 has been said out loud as often in human history, especially here in America, as it has been, you know, during the last 4 or 5 years because of the, you know, the virus thing. And it's not a coincidence. And also the website where these recordings are posted reached its 19th anniversary earlier this year. And it's sad for me to know that the website where these recordings are posted will, that when its 20th anniversary or birthday comes around, it will be with America dead. And I hope that, well, technically the website will, yeah, hopefully it will make it to its 20th birthday. But if and when it does, it will be with the country dead. So in other words, America did not live long enough to see the website's 20th birthday. And I know that is not a coincidence. It's just a reflection of our perennial adolescence. We never grew up, and I think that is part of the reason why, without me meaning to, it's as if I was being prompted to say sandpit all over again, because we stayed like little children in the playground without ever maturing. And by the way, federalism always talks about people who support the concept of federalism are always saying, well, federalism is so wonderful because our founding fathers, you know, that stupid phrase that they always use, our founding fathers, they wanted it to be this a test tube kind of situation where, you know, you try a law locally and if it works, then the neighboring states will say, oh, wonderful, let's imitate that law. And so because there's no centralized control, then the federal system allows you to experiment, you know, in a given state, they try a new thing, you know, and they have the freedom to try it without having to get the authorization of the federal government. They try it, and if it works, they keep it, and then the other states will see it and emulate it and so forth. So it's always this, they picture it as this wonderful, you know, place of experimentation, you know, and that's what a sandbox is, like in computer terminology. Software developers say, you know, when they talk about a sandbox, they're referring to an environment where they are testing out new code, test out ideas, and once it gets out of the sandbox, it goes into the development branch, and then the Q&A branch, and then eventually the production branch, and so forth. But the sandbox branch, you could say, is where people just test out new ideas. So in a sense, yes, federalism, you know, was this supposed attempt at us having this wonderful democracy, these little sandpits of experimentation, and ironically, these experiments were always permanent. So yes, the South decided, well, let's try the system where you have one race of people being enslaved, permanently enslaved, and not be treated as human beings. Let's have that system. Let's experiment with that. But the thing is, when you experiment with stuff, I mean, if it's wrong or there's something not right with it, you supposedly kind of end the experiment and try again. But federalism doesn't act like that. When federalism is institute a law that is not right, or a system that's not right, and it just becomes permanent. It never goes away. That concept of experimentation that our founding fathers had, blah blah blah, it's all a whole bunch of horse manure. That's all it is. It is this fantastic imagery that is painted because you know, in the minds of people who glorify the founding fathers and who want to glorify American history and all that, and it never panned out that way. You know, the experiment of slavery, for example, had to end with the bloodshed of the death of 600,000 Americans. And even then it wasn't finished. We had to go another 100 years, and the problem really never got properly resolved. So these permanent sand traps, these permanent sand pits of quote experimentation, never work out. And that's also part of the sand pit thing that we became trapped in this sand pit that out of which we never matured. So that's one thing we wanted to share. And the second thing is speaking of being, you know, trapped in a sand pit, that weather pattern continue that it's over the U.S. continues to be stuck, just like the country became permanently stuck in its sand pit of stupidity. This weather pattern has just remained over the U.S. just there, and this high pressure system has been sitting over the south of the U.S., especially, you know, the Southwest, but more or less over the entire South and into the Southwest. And it's been there, and it's creating this horrendous heat wave. And for example, in Phoenix, Arizona, where I had the chance or to live for like for a few months before my eventual return to the New York area. In Phoenix, Arizona, they on July 18th, a few days ago, they broke the record for most days with 110 degree plus weather, 110 degrees Fahrenheit. Not sure what that translates to in centigrade. And I should have done this earlier, but let me do it right now. Using the formula, it's 110 degrees is about 43 degrees centigrade or Celsius. That's how hot it is. And Phoenix has had it had a record of 18 that had been set back in 1974, you know, the year that that Nixon resigned with the Watergate scandal. And maybe we'll talk about that a little more someday. We have kind of briefly mentioned how that's a reflection, the 100-year anniversary of 1874, that horrible election when America sold out, that we briefly talked about before. So it's interesting that on that 100 years later, when the Republican Party was exposed as weak, and the Democrat Party had been allowed to take power in a significant way, on the 100-year anniversary of that, Phoenix had this record heat of 18 days of 110 degree plus weather. And that record was broken with a record of 19, interestingly enough, on July the 18th. But the record has continued, and now as of yesterday, the record was 22 and counting. So today, you know, the day that this recording will get posted might be the 23rd day of the record being continued. And I think it will maybe go on two or three more days from what I've heard. So it's been an intense heat, and they've had in Phoenix as of yesterday, July 21st, 12 consecutive days of lows of 90 degrees Fahrenheit or higher. And just for those who are centigrade oriented, it's 90 degrees is 32 degrees more or less centigrade. And I think I could be wrong, but I think America is the only country on Earth that uses Fahrenheit. I'm not sure who else uses it. So everybody else around the world uses centigrade. We use Fahrenheit. And I personally don't feel the temperature when they say it in centigrade or Celsius. I always have to do the conversion in my head. I don't quite understand centigrade. I don't feel it, and that's because I've grown up, you know, listening to the temperature in Fahrenheit and feeling it in real life, so I know. So when they say 95, I go, okay, that's hot, and I get a sense of how hot that is. But if somebody says 33 centigrade, I go, okay, that sounds hot, but I'm not sure how hot that is. So, but yeah, but the thing is that in Phoenix, we've had that they've had 12 consecutive days as of yesterday of 90 degrees Fahrenheit as the low. So, you know, a low of 90 degrees or higher. So it's been, in other words, even at night, they have no rest. And that is a figure of what we will have when America is dead. There will be no place to rest. No place you can go to hide and say, well, I'll just go live in Florida, or I'll just go live in Texas, or I'll just go live wherever, and I'll be safe, and I'll go to a red state with a red governor, and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, you might have a certain measure of a respite, if you can call it that, but there will be no real rest. There will be nowhere to hide, nowhere to run. Oh, baby, nowhere to hide, as the song would say. It's like a flood. You just can't get away from it. It will come and get you wherever you are. Conservatives don't understand that. They think they can take their refuge in their federal little sandpits, these places of experimentation and refuge where they will be able to implement their own little laws and protect themselves from wokeness, as they call it, and all this other stuff. And sorry, it's not going to work. I can assure you that a few things change in Florida, and the wonderful success of Republicans there and all that can go to hell in a heartbeat. And they will elect Charlie Crist type worthless piece of human excrement as governor, some Democrat, and then everything that was built will be torn apart. It is that because Americans are fickle people. We vote based on the latest thing. You know, we always sing Janet Jackson's song, "What Have You Done For Me Lately?" And if things are off for some reason in the economy or whatever, you know, then we'll vote for the other party because this party's not working, instead of looking at the deeper issues, the underlying issues, and so forth. And for example, in Florida, they have had this extra inflation as compared to other parts of the country. And what has happened is that they've had such an influx of people trying to flee to Florida and live in Florida that has created a high demand for real estate and, you know, for houses and, you know, apartments, flats, you know, for people to live. So rent has become extraordinarily high. And you add on top of that the inflation that's already there created by the bite me policies. Artificial oil reduction, and you have this high inflation in Florida, and that's why I'm saying if things take a wrong turn in some way, the people of Florida, I have no doubt would on a heartbeat just decide to vote for a Democrat. To be governor, and then everything that DeSantis and the Republicans there have tried to do would just come undone. So there's nowhere to hide, and that's reflected in the fact that in Phoenix, they've had these 12 days of 90 degree plus lows. That means that at night, when you think that, oh, finally, I'm going to have some rest from this heat, you still feel 90 degree weather. In the cool quote of the night. So there's no rest even at night. And in the same way, there will be no rest even in red states as when the country is dead. And just as a side note, in Phoenix, they've said that I was reading this Yahoo story. They are very liberal and all that, but sometimes you have to go to these places to get some of the news. And this Yahoo story, it's titled, it's from AccuWeather, which is not such a bad website. But it's posted on Yahoo News but it's from AccuWeather, and the title of it is Phoenix Heat Wave Could Be the Most Intense on Record for the City. And this it was posted on Friday, July 21st. And they mentioned here it's called the AccuWeather Heat Wave Severity Index. And they must have some sort of formula that tries to kind of quantify the duration and intensity of a heat wave. And based on their calculations, the top 6 years of the highest heat wave severity index, number one right now is the year 2023, with a severity index of 65, and it's for the heat wave, and that's measuring the heat wave from June 30th of 2023. Interesting, June 30th was the first day after June 29th that we spoke about, and I know that's not a coincidence. This is if after June 29th, on the first day afterwards, June 29th being this day, the 20th anniversary of the death of Latin America, and kind of like a sign or a warning or an alert that we are about to have our June 29th later this year. In other words, the year our own death, just like Latin America died 20 years ago, it's calling everything about it just died 20 years ago. In the same way, we'll have that death happening soon. And so the very next day, a severe heat wave started in Phoenix. And so from June 30th to July 20th, as of July 20th, the severity index is 65, and that would cover 21 days, and the heat wave will continue. So I'm sure that heat index number is going to be higher. So that's number one. The second place for the highest index was in Phoenix was 1995. That was the year of the O.J. Simpson trial and acquittal. Because the glove wouldn't fit, so they decided to acquit, and they let the murderer go. And black people also, we briefly talked about this before, if I'm not mistaken, is that black people on that year also made a decision that they were going their personal interests were more important than justice. And they were willing to support a murderer just because he was black, and that's how, and that kind of a seed, a very terrible seed, was sown in 1995 by black America, and that seed has just grown and grown and grown to the point now that people who are hardened criminals are defended and treated as victims just because they're black. And so in that year of 1995, there was a heat wave from July 25th to August, through August 10th. And that heat wave, in other words, that was, 17 days? And that heat wave created an index of 36, you know, based on whatever formula they use to calculate that index. So in other words, the second place year, 1995, which was 28 years ago, around 27, 28 years ago, had a heat wave index that is almost half of this year's in Phoenix. That's how severe this one is, that the index is 65 this year, at least as of July 20th, and it was 36 in 1995, which had been the highest or the most intense heat wave recorded in Phoenix up until now. And then third place, 1974. So, you know, the year of that we talked about a moment ago, the heat wave index for that year was 34 for a heat wave that went from June 12th through June 29th. Interesting. There you go. So this is it. The heat wave of 1974 went from June 12th through June 29th, 18 days. And then the heat wave of this year started the very next day, calendar-wise, June 30th. And it's going on. This is not a coincidence. It's like a pattern here. And again, a heat wave index of 34 for 1974, which is almost half of this year's as well. And then fourth place in Phoenix history was the heat wave of 1990 that went from June 20 through June 28th. And that had a heat wave index of 29. It was a 9-day heat wave. And interesting, June 20th through June 28th, the day before June 29th. And it had a heat wave index of 29. It's like there's a chain, like a daisy chain. Of these heat waves connected with each other. And just as a final note, fifth and sixth highest indexes were recorded in 2017 and 2021. So in other words, they were recent years. The one in 2017 had a heat wave index of 26 and went from June 17th through June 27th, 11 days. And the one in 2021 had a heat wave index of 25 from June 12th through June 20th, which is what, 9 days. So the thing is that the reason why I mentioned these last two is that, yes, we have had more heat in some places, but there is no... all of this has been taken as an excuse to say, oh yeah, global warming is real. Well, the reason why they stopped saying global warming is because the heat, the temperatures across the earth, the average temperature were not indicative of things heating up. So they had to change the terminology to continue with the Chicken Little crisis. So they changed it to climate change. So whenever something happened, climate change, then, oh yes, we have to save the planet and all that stuff. And now that we've had this heat wave in specific parts of the world, then, oh yeah, now they're talking about global warming again. But as you can see, the highest heat waves were back in 95, 74, 1990. And we have had these two recent ones in Phoenix, 2017 and 2021. But if the global warming thing was real, then you would have seen like a progressive thing. Like as the years went by, then that in the 1980s, you would have had a heat wave being recorded on this list of the top six. And in the 1990s, you've seen 90, 91, 93, 95. And then in the 2000s, there's nothing between 1995 and 2017. That's 22 years of no heat wave that makes it to the top six, shall we say. So there is no progression. And the reason why these things are happening is because it's a reflection of the judgment on this country. It's a reflection of where we are. It's as if, like what happened in 2004 and 2005. Those were 2004 was the first year of the website where these recordings are posted, and that year, Florida and the Gulf of Gulf Coast in America began to get hit with hurricanes just coming. And the sudden wave of hurricanes as had not been, you know, before. And everybody started saying, oh, the global warming, oh, we're destroying the planet. That's why these things are happening. And then that was 2004, 2005. It's as if when the website was born, a storm was created. Like, okay, you know, here we go. And every storm was reflecting things, and we talked about that on the website where these postings are recorded. You know, as each hurricane would come, we would talk about, you know, what it all represents and everything. And I got tired after 2005 of hearing this nonsense. Oh, this climate change and all that stuff. And it's as if I said, oh, enough. And it's as I said in my heart, like, okay, we'll not have any more storms. We're not gonna have any more hurricanes. Just so you know, it has nothing to do with your global warming ideology. And then suddenly it stopped, and we didn't have any major, you know. We would have a few hurricanes every now and then, you know, in the news and all that. But in general, that incidence of things just stopped happening. And what I'm trying to say is, a lot of these sudden weather-related crises or things are a reflection of other things going on. Yeah, you could say that they are, as these activists, crazy people say, it's human. Induced, but it's not human induced because of, you know, carbon emissions or cow gas emissions, or it has nothing to do with that. It's our behavior, our attitudes, our thoughts, or things that are happening, and the weather seems to reflect what's going on in the atmosphere, but not just the literal weather atmosphere. I mean, the atmosphere of human activity, so that's. And in 2005, that was the year of the. Also, at the end of that year, the big tsunami, as some of you may recall, the tsunami that killed a quarter of a million people, I think, if I remember correctly, in different parts, including India and all that. And I remember that. That day, on the website, we posted something that was very, very significant. It is as if that the posting of that, the beginning of the posting of these thoughts that we had on the, you'll have to go look it up if you're interested. But when we posted these ideas, that's when the earthquake happened. I remember that afternoon. It was a Saturday afternoon. I was typing these ideas out. And I said, "Wow, these are things that have never been said before," and I was stunned at what I was typing, and that was the day I was watching the news, and then the story about this big earthquake that was causing a tsunami and ended up killing lots of people. And what I'm trying to say is that the weather is sometimes a reflection of things that are happening. They're shaking the atmosphere of human activity. Even if people don't see it, but they things are done and they have a ripple effect, and then things get reflected, and then all the idiots start using that as an excuse to justify their agenda, and they don't understand. It has nothing to do with what you're talking about. It's something else that's going on, but you're too stupid, too blind, too limited to understand what's happening. And that's what's going on right now. I forget where it was, somewhere in the Midwest or somewhere, they were talking about, hail. I saw on the weather, on the wet Fox Weather channel that I kind of inadvertently flipped to, they were mentioning that, this, I forget, but there was a year that they talked about the number of hailstorms we have had in the country, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact numbers, but let's just say some numbers, and I might be way off, but I'm just trying to give you a proportion of the numbers. They were saying that in a certain year, there was this great amount of hailstorm activity in the country. It was like 3,500 hailstorms for the entire year across the country, and that we had like over 4,000 or 5,000 so far this year, and we are all, you know, in the through a little past the middle, past the half, you know, first half of the year, so we still have a long way to go to end the year, and we already have gone past. I think it was the number they were comparing against must have been the record for most hailstorms in the country. So we're getting pounded literally with hail from the sky, as if to say, America, you're dying. And you're despised now. You're not America the beautiful anymore. You're America the hideous. And I'm going to pound you, and I'm going to make you aware of how hideous you are. And you say, oh yeah, the liberals have turned this country. No. Yes, the liberals have done a lot of disaster, but as I keep saying over and over again, the real culprits of all of this are the conservatives. And the Christians, the American conservative Christians, because they are they could have changed everything if they had just changed their attitude, if they were close to the truth, close enough to hear what had to be said, hear what had to be done, and what had to be said and done, and they said no, thank you, we know what we're doing. Because they knew that embracing the fuller dimension of truth would imply taking the idols that they have, that give them comfort, that give them security, and shattering these idols against the rocks. And they said, no. I spent so much money buying this little idol. I'm not going to destroy it. And because of that, they've started rejecting. And as we shared before, May 24th of this year, it's as if all of them, they were tolerant of the truth seekers saying deeper things in the atmosphere. They were tolerant, like they didn't like it, but they said, okay, whatever, we're gonna tolerate you, but we're going to ignore you. But now on May 24th, it's as if they said, no, we're not just going to just accept your annoying presence, we're going to turn our backs on it, and we're going to put a dam with our backs against any efforts that you may have to make the truth prevail and be the king in this country, because we don't want your truth. Thank you very much. We have our version of the truth, which is falsehood, and that's why the country is dying. They are the ones who are guilty. And that's why we are getting pounded with hail. It's as if to say, hey, you stupid. That's what every hailstone or whatever it's called, ball of hail or whatever, is saying as it hits the ground. Stupid country, stupid people, stupid, stubborn people who don't want to embrace the truth. So we have a country of people who are stuck with a half-truth, and then the other half or more than half just nuts, you know, completely disconnected with the truth, living in this liberal stupidity. So we have these two groups, and that's why the country's dying. And just as another side note regarding heat, I saw this headline on this conservative website that was talking about the fake news about a heat wave that has swept across southern Europe. Basically they were talking about the lie. It's on NOQ report, which is called now America First Report. And we've said what we think about the term America First in the past, so I'm not going to go there. The thing is that website, NOQ Report, which is now called America First Report, but if you type noqreport.com, it will redirect you to their silly new address. And the article that they have there posted a day ago, as of this recording, it says that, quote, heat wave the media said spread through southern Europe last week, just more climate lies. So they go on to explain that they were talking about 48 degrees centigrade heat in some parts and all that, but it turns out that, and at 48 degrees centigrade would be 118 Fahrenheit, which is very hot, which is kind of like the highs in I think today's or yesterday's high in Phoenix was 119 or something like that Fahrenheit. So it's even above it. So yes, there are places where there really is a 48 degree high, but they were saying that that it was happening across Southern Europe. But it turns out that in places like Italy, Spain, France, Germany, and Poland, but it turns out that they were talking about ground temperature, not air temperature. In other words, when you touch the ground, you know, how hot it feels in the asphalt. It makes sense, you know, because the asphalt just retains the heat. So it's going to, if you touch it, it's going to burn. You know, it's like what they said in Phoenix, that if you broke an egg on the asphalt, it would fry right there on the spot. And when I was there, I tried that. We tried that once, but it didn't. I don't remember. The egg kind of fried a bit, but not as, you know, dramatically as expected. But I guess now it would be. But the thing is that the story was talking about the lies that that the media have been trying to say, you know, putting out the number of 48 degrees, talking about the ground temperature, but it's actually the air temperature that counts, and that one is not as high. And when you consider the air temperature, like for example, it says here, the hottest it got in Sicily, in Italy, over the weekend was 32 degrees centigrade, or about 90 degrees Fahrenheit. That is a far cry from the 48 degrees centigrade that was originally reported, because again, they were focusing on ground temperature. And then they made the clarification. They always do that, you know, to kind of save face. They always do like the correction later on, but the correction is always done afterwards. It's like an afterthought, and in a very silent way or a very discreet way, shall we say, just to cover their behinds and save face and all that. So technically they corrected themselves, but they don't, but they do that all on purpose all the time, because what they want to do is create the impression. And that's all they care about, the impression. Just like what happened with ClimateGate in the UK, I think it was the Imperial College, that horrible scandal that happened in the early 2000s, I think it was around 2004, 2005, when it was exposed that people from I think it was the Imperial College or whatever the hell it's called, weather scientists had been reporting for years about the climate change and global warming, and they had the hockey stick graph to show how heat has suddenly increased, and you know, it was all to justify their global warming ideology, and it turned out to be false and was exposed. And I remember, I think I may have shared this before, I was watching a BBC show called Hard Talk. I forget the name of the host, but I like to watch that show every now and then. That's when I had cable and I could see that show. Because the host, he would just go after people and question them, but it was not in a mean way or an ideologically biased way. It was just, he would just ask the tough questions, and that's why the show was called Hard Talk. And you could see that there was sincerity in, like, searching for the truth, and you could see that there was no agenda in the questioning. It was just asking the hard questions. So he was interviewing one of these guys who had been exposed in this ClimateGate, and you can look it up if you are not aware of it. If you look up ClimateGate, unless you know the search results are controlled by Google or any of these bastards, you should theoretically be able to find it. It was called ClimateGate. It was a big story in a lot of places. It became a big story around the world. But unfortunately, a lot of people, to my surprise, were not aware of it, even though it was a big story. But I guess it was because the media tried to muffle it. But it was a big story. It was not like some conspiracy theory. It happened. It was exposed, scientifically exposed. These two guys I think it was the Imperial College in London, produced these papers, including the hockey stick graph. It's like a famous graph in the global warming, cult. And turns out it was all false, and it was exposed that they had made it up, and they had to admit it was made up. So this guy from Hard Talk was interviewing this man and asking him, why did you lie? You made up. You're a scientist. You're supposed to just show the facts and let the facts, you know, take people, you know, where they may. But he said, no. Well, the thing is, the ideas that we were, the conclusions that we were proposing, are still true and are still valid. But sometimes this is what the guy was saying. I'm paraphrasing, of course. I don't remember the exact words, but he almost literally said something like, well, sometimes you have to lie to get people to understand the dangers of what is coming. You have to lie to them to get them to become aware of the reality of the danger. This was a scientist saying this on television in front of, you know, this guy who was confronting him. And that's how, you know, these people are. They lie. They know they're lying, and they are fudging the facts. But in their minds, they justify it because they say, "Oh well, the danger is real. It's scientifically valid. It's real. I know it's real. I just have to get people to be scared enough to make the changes that I want them to make. So I'm just gonna fudge things a bit." So this is what the media, you know, always do. They fudge things and they put it out there. They say all these things to create the impression. Then they make the, you know, the side correction 3 or 4 or 5 or 2 weeks later on page 95 of, you know, not in the front page, but way buried somewhere. And but the impression is left. And all the naive fools who follow the religion of liberalism are just left with the impression, and that's all they care about. And this is kind of what's happening here. And I just wanted to mention this side thing just to illustrate that what's happening in America is not a global warming. And because people say, oh, well, it's happening all over the world and all that. Yes, there's heat going on in other places as well. But there's no pattern. What's happening right now in America is very specific to America. And if you hear exaggerations about things, there might be some extra heat in some parts of Europe and all that. But it's summer, for a starter, so you expect the heat. But what's happening in America, so what you hear from the rest of the world will probably be, you have to take it with a grain of sodium chloride. You have to say, well, there might be, they are exaggerating. It's not as bad as, because they want to take what's happening in America and use it to say, oh, the whole world is burning up and we have to do climate change and we have to stop cows from you know, doing their gas emissions and all this stuff. And we have to stop breathing, and we have to turn to electric stoves and electric cars and all this nonsense, and we have to ditch our cars and go back to primitive times and all that stuff. So what's happening is very specific to this country, because this country is dying this year, and that is the reality of it. There is a darkness over this nation, and it's just getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And I have felt it every day. I just feel the darkness. It is very, very dark. I've been very, very fortunate, very blessed that the weather, all the bad things that have happened, have kind of hit around the New York area, like upstate New York, or sometimes further south, or a little bit to the west, but it's never as bad here. But because I think it's out of mercy to me, and people like me who are here in the New York area who are seeking or making an effort to seek the truth, and we're not to be blamed for all this, and we're not getting so New York is being spared from the brunt of all this stuff. Because there are people, very few here, who are trying to seek the truth. And in a sense, we're being spared, mercifully spared, from a lot of the bad things going on. But even with things not being as bad weather-wise here as they are in other parts of the country, when I go out in here in New Jersey or in New York, I just feel the darkness. It is getting more evil. The people are behaving more nastily. And one of the people, groups of people who have kind of like stepped up to the front to show me how evil the country has become are Indian people. And I've shared this before. It's like, sometimes I feel like somebody took a picture of me. Some Indian guy or Indian woman took a picture of me and started distributing it over, maybe that's actually what happened, who knows, on social media and spread it to everybody to say, target this guy. I mean, that's almost how it feels. Like they all decided, because I remember once, it all started a certain day, I forget the exact date of it, but it started with something that happened. A very subtle thing with an Indian guy. Very subtle thing. And maybe we'll talk about that some other time. Because I think there's a relevance. There's something about India that's not right, especially now. The thing is that the very next, I think two days later, I went out to New York. And I remember it's like Indian people were looking to run into me and hit me. And trying to run me over from behind. It was like, and I said, where are all these Indian people coming from? I had not been aware that there were so many Indians in Hoboken. And they were all over the place and they were coming after me. It was weird, very, very, and it's been happening and happening and happening. I just wanted to share one thing that happened. And I know this sounds like, why is he talking about this? I believe it's all related somehow. And I'm just pointing this out as a sign of the darkness here and also a warning of a potential problem in England as a result. And I was, this was a day or two ago, I went out on my lunch break to buy some food. I went into this place. And I ordered, and I stood, somewhere waiting, to get my order and then leave. And as I was waiting, behind me in the queue was this Indian lady, tall Indian lady, unusually tall, in red, and she looked Indian. And she ordered, and then I could feel that, I don't know, it was weird. I could feel that she saw me. She turned around and saw me, and I could, I don't know, it's very strange. I felt the disdain, like just utter disdain at my presence there. Like I was this leper. I don't know how to explain it. And she went past me and almost hit me. I had to kind of like back away as much as I could, again, back up against like a thing that was behind me to avoid being hit by her. But she was trying to hit me, but you could feel the, it was almost as if to hit me, not, it was disdain, like you're nothing, you don't exist, and I'm just gonna walk through you kind of attitude. It was strange, I just could feel it. But the thing is, she stood behind me, and she was on her phone, and I didn't look back at her until I noticed that on the computer screen, the little touch screen that right next to the cash register, that it was still waiting for her signature and for her to say how much to tip. Because they have a system there where you order and you swipe your card or whatever, or tap your card, and then it tells you how much to tip. So they have this where they force you to say how much you want to tip people. Some people have complained about that because they've instituted these electronic systems that almost kind of make you, you've got to tip. I have no problems with it, but a lot of people have complained about that because it's kind of very, like, in your face. So they say how much, you know, different options, no tip, 15%, 20%, whatever, and then they ask you to sign. So I always leave a certain tip and I sign and so forth, but she had not done that. She left it on the screen with no signature, no, so the transaction was not complete. So I noticed that, and then I looked back at her, and that's when I saw that she was on her phone and whatever, and I looked at the screen, and I looked at her, and I said, okay, I don't think she's aware that she didn't finish her transaction. And the employees were just going back and forth, and they all were, you know, working on their orders, and no one was noticing that the transaction was not complete. And I said, should I let her know that she needs to finish? Because I said, well, you know, for one, the employees could, you know, tip themselves, you know, because she didn't finish the transaction, just tip themselves and press enter. And but I think that the employees there would not have done that. The ones that I've, because I go there every now and then, so I don't think they would have done that. But even so, there was this possibility of her being, you know, taken advantage of because she left the thing unfinished. And on top of that, because she had not completed the transaction, then the order would not be registered, and they'd probably not be, I don't know, maybe there'd be a problem with the order because it didn't get completed. So there were, I was thinking about all these things, thinking about, worrying about her. It was not my problem, but I said, should I tell her something? And I looked at her, well, she's Indian. Oh, no, I don't think so. And I could, you know, and I felt that disdain thing happen before. And I said to myself, should I say something? And I felt, no, don't do anything. And I said, oh, but she might need to know. And against my better judgment, I went ahead and I said, oh, ma'am. And I said this with a smile on my face, despite the disdain I'd felt and all that. I just said it with this smile, this, you know, a cordial smile on my face. And I said, oh, ma'am, I think your transaction didn't finish, or you need to finish your transaction. And then she didn't even, she just looked at this, you know, from a distance. She saw the monitor, the touchscreen thing, and she didn't even say, oh, thank you. She didn't acknowledge me having spoken to her. And she just went past me, went to the touchscreen. I don't know how much she tipped. I didn't notice she did this semi-signing thing. And then she went past me again without even looking at me and saying a word. Then she stood where she was, had been standing. And I looked back at her. She was not even looking at me. Nothing. As if a servant, as if a lower level servant had spoken to her that was not even worthy of being seen by her or being addressed, or no thank you, no nothing. And then she got her order, and as she left, I said real loud, ingratitude, part of the Indian culture. And I don't know if she heard it, but there was another lady that was next to me. And she heard it, and she turned around, and I could feel her disgust at what I had just said. But she didn't understand what had happened, or maybe she did and didn't care anyway. But I just want to share that there is a certain arrogance in the Indian. And again, I just don't understand where the hell that arrogance comes from. Because if you're good, you're awesome good, and you're like, Americans would have the greatest reasons to be proud. Well, not up until recently, but like 20, 30, 40 years ago, an American would have every reason, not justified, but would understandably have a reason to be proud, because America was the most powerful nation on earth, the most powerful economy, one of the greatest economic wonders in human history. Technologically advanced, dominating in every aspect and all that. But what does India have to brag about? I mean, they have perennial hunger, perennial poverty. They worship rats, literally, and they have snake festivals where everybody's holding snakes. And they still have leprosy. They have this horrible caste system with the untouchables and all this stuff and all these levels of just disgusting. I think I may have mentioned this before, but and I have a feeling we're not going to get to Rutherford B. Hayes, but all of this needs to be said. There's used to be a comedian called, Russell Peters, I think his name is, and I could be wrong, but that's what I remember. And he's of Indian descent, a Canadian of Indian descent. His parents are Indian, if I'm not mistaken. I think they came from India and arrived in Canada, but he's Canadian. But he has this English sounding name, Russell Peters, but I don't know what his real name is. The thing is that I heard one of his stand-up skits one time, and he was joking about his first visit to India. And he said, oh, I'm going to be there. He was so excited. I'm going to be there with my people and all this. And he said that when he got off the plane, he said the first thing that hit him as he got off the plane was the smell. He said, ooh, this smells. And it was not a pleasant smell. So he was saying that, I forget where he landed, maybe New Delhi, who knows where. But he said the first thing that hit him was the stench of the city. And then he started joking about how things were so different there, that he was surprised, that he was shocked that he was seeing these Indian men. He said it. Well, I'm not going to say the exact words that he said, but he said grown men, but he used another term. Grown men, he would see them on the streets walking, holding hands, but not their hands, you know, holding pinkies, you know, like interlocking their pinkies and walking around and almost like in this, like almost as if they were dancing, walking around together. And he was shocked by all these strange things he was seeing in India. And then he said, well, I realized that I had all this thing about feeling that I was here with my people and all that. And then I realized I'm really Canadian. I'm not Indian. I'm Canadian. And he, you know, talked about all these things that he saw. And I'm trying to point out, you know, even a person of Indian descent sees the clash, that there's something in the culture that's weird, you know. So there's nothing to be proud about, but there's a certain arrogance in the Indian. And I don't know why, maybe because I'm of a short stature, and maybe there's something about my skin tone. I don't know. I'm brown skinned, but it's not a dark brown, or I would dare say it gets darker in the summer, but maybe, I don't know, maybe there is something about my skin tone that reminds them of untouchables. I don't know what it is, or maybe it's just the aura around me. There's something that they despise, and they always try to put me down every time I relate. I'm not saying that every Indian has been like that, because sometimes in work environments I've been surrounded by the right amount of decent Indian people, and some have been very nice to me. But people who don't know me in general on the streets, when I've related with Indian people, they've always been very rude to me, very rude. And I've always seen the contrast when they deal with me, and then the very next second I see them interacting with a white person, and the behavior is just completely different, like night and day. Like when I go to a store, and I am at the cash register, and the Indian guy treats me like trash, like rubbish, and then the right person right behind me is white. And as I'm leaving, I see the complete change in their face and their countenance when they see the white person interact with them. But when they interact with me, it's like I don't know what it is exactly, but I don't know if I look like the untouchables in their pathetic, worthless little country or what. I don't know what it is, but there's something evil in the Indian culture. And I find it annoying when Christian missionaries and all these people, you know, focus so much on India and all this stuff. You know, what the hell are you doing? That country has been missionized a million times, and they still worship their rats. They worship their cows. I mean, it's so stupid. Such a backward country where they think the cow is sacred. Literally, they have sacred cows, and you. If a cow decides to plant itself in the middle of the street, they have to stop traffic because, you know, they can't kill the sacred cow or even touch it because it's sacred. I mean, what the hell are you so proud about? That's what I say to myself. A country full of superstitious people, and not just, it's just stupid superstitions and disgusting superstitions and a culture of oppression, of caste oppression. And maybe because I've always been anti-caste in my heart, I think that's what they feel. And it's as if they feel a defiance, like I am challenging them and saying, you are worth, your culture is worthless. Even without me saying a word, it's as if I am exposing in their hearts how disgusting they are. And they hate it. And it's not that I'm being harsh with them. Sometimes I try to be as kind and nice and amicable with them as I can be, but they still don't like it. There's something. So, and I feel that's a danger that's coming, that's going to be in England. Because Indians are the British Hispanics, and they will cause problems with any hope of any change in England after America dies, and they need to be fought against, and I don't know why I've had this thing recently, the surge of awareness about Indian people, and. It's always been my focus, that, you know, the evil of the Hispanics, but for some reason it's not been, well, the Hispanics are still evil. They're still harassing me and doing all these nasty things. But now the Indian people are joining in, and there's something going on there that I still don't quite grasp. And the next thing we wanted to talk about the story about Messi, and I don't mean Messi as in messed up. I mean the Argentinian football player. He turns out, I didn't know, he was signed by the Inter Miami football team. Or soccer, or whatever you want to call it, in Florida. So he's now in America, and he's going to be playing. And I think yesterday, the day before this recording, was his first game. And I saw this headline on the Daily Mail saying something like, Lionel Messi will be playing 16 years to the, you know, starting his play, you know, his career in America. 16 years to the day that Beckham started his career in America with the LA Galaxy. So Beckham, David Beckham, you know, came to America and he played for the LA Galaxy. And that was apparently 16 years ago to the day, which would be 2007. So this British player came to America to play in 2007 for the LA Galaxy. And now, 16 years later, to the day, this Argentinian bastard is coming to play for Inter Miami. Instead of Inter Milan, it's Inter Miami. I think he's going to be paid $60 million or some crazy figure like that. And it's been this hoopla about him coming to America. And to me, that's a sign, like an additional confirmation of the end of the country. I don't know how to take Beckham coming to play for the Galaxy in 2007, but if you have to take it in a positive sense, it's like a figure of America, you know, England coming to America, the good things of England coming to America. But now, instead of things coming from England to America, now we have things from the Hispanic third world coming to contaminate America. So, and Argentina in particular, if you have been listening to all these recordings, you may recall that it was the World Cup where Argentina played France in the final, and what happened in that final that made it jolted me and made me aware it's hopeless, it's over. that's when I realized it's all over. And it's as if I had been struggling to hold on to the dream. And when that World Cup final happened, and the way it happened, I realized it was not just a sign of something wrong with the World Cup or whatever. It was something wrong with not just with the world. It was something wrong with everything, especially here in America. It's as if that was the sign that it was all over. And I've been saying this: when America dies less than 2 months from now, it's going to go into this decline. It's not going to be right off the bat. It's not going to die. Like, you know, it's not like everybody's going to die that day. It's going to go on a decline. And I would say 30 years, it could be less than that. But just to be an optimistic number, would be 30 years. But I think it might end up being much faster than that. But there's going to be this decline economically, culturally, because all the blessings, everything that's been so precious about this country, everything, the little that remains will be taken away. And all you'll see is the afterglow. You know, it's like those, like when you have, there are certain things that glow in the dark, so they get hit by light, and when you turn off the light, it glows. But the glow only lasts for a while, and then it disappears. It's the same thing with America. It'll still have this bit of a glow, but it's just the afterglow. And then it eventually will fade and become nothing. And you're going to see the economic collapse, the cultural collapse, the quality of what's produced. That's why we have the strike in Hollywood right now. It's a figure of that collapse. So the collapse is going to be more evident. The quality of the films, the music's going to get worse and worse and worse. The economy is going to go on a decline, and we are going to become Argentina. And I've said this before, and I've said it over and over again. And when I think about the future of America, I think Argentina. That's where we're going. And Argentina, as we've said before, was one of the wealthiest, best economies in the world at the start of the 20th century. Many people don't know this. Argentina was very Europeanized. It's not like the rest of Latin America. It had a strong combination of Spanish and Italian influence. The Amerindian influence was very limited. It was basically like a European country in the middle of Latin America, just like Uruguay and Brazil to some extent. Brazil is more like similar to the U.S. maybe than Europe, but Argentina was more similar to Europe in many ways. Argentina, Uruguay. Uruguay is almost like an extension of Argentina in a certain way. They sound alike when they talk and all that. The thing is that Argentina and Uruguay were amongst the wealthiest economies in the world, maybe in the top five. That's how wealthy and you know, prosperous they were at the beginning of the 20th century. And then they started on the decline, especially when they voted in Perón and I forget the name of the guy, Juan, I think it was. I mean, they're all called Juan, I guess. Juan Perón, I think, and his wife, Evita, the one with the play, Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. But the thing is that when they elected these socialists, then the country began its decline. It just continued declining. And now, right now, I mean, they claim that we won the World Cup. They didn't really win the World Cup, as we've explained before. But they feel like they're world champions and all this and all that. And Latin America feeling proud. We finally won a World Cup since Latin America had been rejected in 2003. And had died, they are all proud of their win, quote unquote, but their economy is in a complete collapse. Right now they have like 140% inflation, and homelessness, just a total collapse. And it's a judgment on Argentina. Cursed is Argentina. Cursed is Argentina. And so they are in a collapse, and America is going to be like that. Having been one of the most prosperous countries on earth, it's going to go Argentina's route, and it's going to be on this decline. And yes, there's going to be like this residue of wealth from all the wealth that America has accumulated over the decades. But it is going to run out, and then you're going to see this increasing gap in social classes, the social mobility that America was so famous for or so renowned for is going to dissipate, and then you're just going to have this stagnation. And a few wealthy people and then a lot of poor people. The economy is going to collapse. The culture is going to collapse. And Messi coming to play in America is a figure of that. It's like a symbol of what's coming. And it's sad that he's playing in Miami in Florida. So that is even more indication to me. Yeah, there's nowhere to hide, nowhere to run, oh baby, nowhere to hide. Even if you go down to Florida, the collapse is going to come and get you. So that to me is very, very significant as well. And I, just as a side note, yesterday, just as I was seeing the story about Messi, I also saw this story about this Argentinian, I think on the Daily Mail as well, this Argentinian football player who committed suicide. And I think he was playing for one of the lower leagues there, lower divisions, or maybe not. I didn't quite read all the details, but they were showing a video of him. They were playing a game, and the referee made a call, and one of the player that he made the call against bitterly complained to the referee, and then a fellow team member who was not directly involved in the play or whatever, came charging at the referee and hit him and started beating him up, left him on the ground, and started kicking him while on the ground, you know, injuring him. I mean, it's a very violent video. It's an Argentinian football player, soccer, whatever you want to call it, player. And then this same guy, apparently, you know, that video went viral of him attacking this referee. And apparently just created this backlash, and he was so distraught over the backlash of the video of him attacking the referee that he committed suicide. And when I read the story, my first reaction was to wave my hand and say bye-bye, you know, like, bye-bye, you know, we're not going to miss you. Because to me, this is the judgment on the Latin American culture. And the more Hispanics die, the better. The culture is cursed, and with every action that they do of violence and all this evil that they do, they are bringing this judgment on themselves, and they are destroying themselves. You don't have to touch them, and they will destroy themselves, and they deserve to be wiped off the face of the earth, and they are going to be continually judged and whittled down and destroyed. And the more intense, you know, like the harassment that they're doing to me, I know that with every harassment that they are releasing judgment to their own lives. And as I was saying that one day, you know, I said, this harassment is going to cause, and I saw it in my head, bloodshed and people being torn apart, Hispanics being bloodied. And I could see them being ripped apart. The very next day, I saw this story about this lady, a Hispanic lady, somewhere in America, but she was of Hispanic descent because of her surname and all that. This lady got ripped up by a lawnmower or some crazy thing like that. And she was just completely torn up. And that's interesting. I was saying that the day before. And it's a confirmation these people are meant to destroy themselves with every evil action that they unleash, because they think the problem with Hispanics is they always have the sense of impunity. They have no respect for things that are holy or sacred or worthy of respect. They are blasphemous people, and they don't care. If they can get away with it, they will do it. And that's why they are, they think they can get away with things. They have this total sense of impunity. And Americans have been kind of enabling that impunity here in America. And they feel that they can get away with more things because white people are just constantly letting them. And that is part, that's what I saw on that day of the World Cup that I tried to describe in a previous audio snippet, as if America was saying, we are okay with this, and we're going to let the impunity become even greater and greater. And that's why we're having all these illegal aliens coming in, Hispanic illegal aliens just flooding in, and so forth. So the floodgate was open, something was opened in America. And they are unleashing this evil. They think they can get away with it, but they will not. It will catch up to them, and they will be judged and killed. Sometimes literally killed. Otherwise, in other cases, completely destroyed, devastated, and their lives will become increasingly miserable as they are wiped off from the. From the face of human history, in a figurative sense, and so it's sad that, and that story about the Argentinian football player committing suicide and after attacking the referee, being right there alongside the story of Messi having his start in his debut in America, I think it's fitting. That's what the Argentinian culture represents now. It used to be so beautiful. There was something very special about the Argentinian people. Despite all their flaws, you could see it, you could feel it. Now it's gone. They died somewhere between 2010 and 2014. It's like they were in a coma for a few years, figurative coma, and then they died around 2014. That's when I saw that they were gone. And it's so sad. And now, 9 years later, America, which also had a lot of beauty to it, is gone. And I was seeing the story about Tony Bennett on the Daily Mail as well. They were, I don't know why, they were talking about him a lot. And they were talking about him singing America the Beautiful before a baseball game with the New York Yankees. I think, but, and I said, what interesting, because I've been saying this to people, that America is no longer America the Beautiful. And then I see this, the very two days later, the story about Tony Bennett, the singer, singing America the Beautiful. And I said, when did he sing this? And turns out he sang it in 1998. And 1998 was the beginning of the period when, of this 20-year period that we had, where we were given the opportunity to start with great, wonderful things. And we've described this in one of the recording, the postings on the website where these recordings are posted. We shared an article on that, 1998, or at least we briefly mentioned it. We are in the midst of writing an article talking a little more about the 1998 period. But 1998 was very special. And I guess, and it was apparently a very impactful performance that day when he sang America the Beautiful. And it's so sad because we can't sing that anymore. America is America, the butt ugly. That if someone had to write a song about America, that would be the song, America the Butt Ugly. Because it's no longer beautiful. It's a hideous place. I hate every moment. When I'm outside, it's like there's always this constant harassment. There are moments when I can find, you know, sometimes rest a bit, but otherwise it's just this constant harassment, and it's very distressing. It's a very evil place now, so just like Argentina used to be beautiful, America was beautiful as well. But both Argentina and America will suffer the same fate, and the United States will be like an Argentina. And I can almost say this with certainty that many years from now, people are going to say that America has declined and has become like Argentina, and they're going to make comparisons. And mark my word on that, they're going to make comparisons to Argentina. They're going to always, when talking about the decline and death of America's nation, some people are going to make the comparison to Argentina and say, this is similar to what happened to Argentina. And it's going to be like, there's going to be a linkage. When people think of America and its decline, they're going to think of Argentina as well. So we have talked about everything except what we were intending to talk about, which was Rutherford B. Hayes. And I have the feeling that it wouldn't be fair to start talking about Rutherford B. Hayes right now. But let me just mention this as the start, and we will hopefully continue this in the next recording. If you go, I'm going to read a paragraph from Rutherford B. Hayes' article on Wikipedia, and I think it ties in with the last things we've been saying. And it says, I'm going to read it verbatim. It says, most of Hayes' foreign policy concerns involved Latin America. In 1878, following the Paraguayan War, he arbitrated a territorial dispute between Argentina and Paraguay. Hayes awarded the disputed land in the Gran Chaco region to Paraguay, and the Paraguayans honored him by renaming a city, and the name of it is Villa Hayes. Villa as in villa, but in Spanish, double L is pronounced like a Y. So it's Villa Hayes, and a department. In other words, they call departments in some countries, a department is like a province or a state. So they have a state or province that they call department. And it's called, there's actually a province in Paraguay called Presidente Hayes. So they named it after Rutherford B. Hayes in his honor. And so that's what, so there's a connection between Hayes and Latin America and Argentina, interestingly enough. So Argentina and Paraguay had a war. And he, for some reason, he was called to arbitrate between the two, not sure why. And he decided to grant this region, the Gran Chaco region, to Paraguay. And the Paraguayans were so happy with that that they named a city and a whole province after him. So weird, you know, to have a country where you go to a country and the name of the province in that country is the name of an American president. And not just the name, actually, Presidente Hayes, as if, just to clarify, it's not just Hayes, we're not just taking the name Hayes, an English name, but it's the name of that guy, that specific guy, Presidente Hayes. And this is significant because Paraguay, in Latin America, the three countries that survived the death of June 29th, 2003, were Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay. And those three countries, and out of those, I think only Brazil remains. And with Brazil, I don't know. It's the only country in the Americas that I have no certainty about regarding its future. Everything else is gone. From Canada all the way down to Tierra del Fuego, everything is gone. Well, not technically yet, but 2 months from now, it's all going to be gone. And the only part of the Americas that still has maybe this ember of hope still kind of burning somewhere is Brazil. But maybe it's dead already, and I just don't know it. I don't know. But the thing is that there were these three countries that remained alive. And these three countries are interconnected with Paraguay geographically. If you look at the map, it's like Paraguay is interconnected with them, with Brazil and Argentina. And I don't know if it borders Uruguay, but Uruguay is right next to Argentina, which is right next to Paraguay. So they're kind of all close to each other. And Paraguay, as we've shared in one very early posting on the website where these recordings are posted, we talked about Paraguay, and the article is called Paraguay and Hell. And we talk about the significance of Paraguay, how it represents the matriarchal system. And it was like this contaminating influence on the other three nations. It's like the three nations, Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay, represented the three male personalities that we've talked about. And Paraguay represented this female contamination of this matriarchal thing. And Hayes, in this dispute between Paraguay and Argentina, sided with Paraguay, with the matriarchal side, you could say. And interestingly now, Argentina, which had hope to live, now is a Paraguay. It behaves like a Paraguay. It has a contamination of the Amerindian violence and all that evil inside of it. So now Argentina and Uruguay are like Paraguay. So, and I think that's, there's a connection there. I don't know how clear it is, but I see it in my head, at least in my head, there is a confirmation. This is all interconnected. So basically what we've talked about here is that first, America is in a sandpit. It remained a teenage country, a juvenile country that refused to grow. And as a result, because we became stuck, now we have a weather pattern that's stuck over the country, breaking all these records. In Phoenix, for example, there are hailstorms all over the country. The country's being pounded. And clearly, America is no longer the beautiful. It's hideous now. It's ugly as sin. It's but ugly to the truth. And that's why it's being pounded and it's being reflected. The weather is reflecting the death that's coming in this this year over this country. And it's very specific to America. People may try to say, oh, this is a worldwide event. Yes, there are weather things going on all over the world. There's always something going on around the world. But what's happening right now is very specific to this country. And I have to remind people that before June 29th, I think it was, the summer here in the New York area had been unusually mild. In the Northeast, here in the U.S., had been unusually mild. I mean, even days when I was outside at night in June, and I was shivering a bit. And I said, my goodness, what the hell's going on? Why am I shivering in the middle of June? And so it had been unusually cold. And then suddenly, it's as if after June 29th, someone turned on the heat. And it's been hot, but you know, at least it's been a kind of tolerably hot here in the New York area. But it's been hot, but nothing to scream about too much. Especially compared with the rest of the country. But so it's not a global warming thing. It's something happening with this country in particular. Something being emphasized to this country, but then we're so stupid we can't comprehend it. The conservatives have no clue. They don't understand what's going on. The liberals all interpret it as meaning, oh, global warming. But, you know, they believe the hockey stick graph from the climate gate people, and they still think it's true. I don't think they got the memo that it was all made up. So all of this is happening because we are stuck, and no one is able to comprehend it. And as all of this is happening, there's this looming thing about the Indian threat. That as America is dying, it's as if the forces are gathering for India to become a source of blockage to the growth of the truth in other parts of the world, especially in England. Because as America dies, it's as if the burden of things or the calling or whatever is being shifted to other countries, and I think in particular. A lot of that shift will go to England. And as that is happening, it's as if the forces of evil, we could call it like that, just to use a figure of speech, these forces of evil are saying they're ramping up and India is becoming this threat. And it's sad, you know, to consider that at present the the Prime Minister of Great Britain is, if I'm not mistaken, of Indian descent. And so that makes me wonder what it all means. And as that's happening in the background, we have America officially becoming an Argentina. And it is being represented by this Messi guy coming to play with this humongous over-the-top salary in Miami, like $60 million. For crying out loud, he's not that good. Really, he's not that good. And if you doubt it, you just... I think he's been, in my personal opinion, he's one of the most overhyped players on earth. You want to watch great players, and the reason why he feels, oh, I've been vindicated, I won the World Cup. They didn't win the World Cup, as we've tried to explain before. They cheated. They Argentinians are like little kids. They play like juvenile delinquents, like this guy who beat up the referee just because he didn't like the call. The Uruguayans who overthrew stuff after they got eliminated, thankfully, and the Arab people were there watching in disbelief, watching them destroy stuff as they were leaving, and like that Uruguayan guy who elbowed. Deliberately hit a FIFA official in the elbow just out of outrage after the game. He did it very surreptitiously, but the video was caught of him, lifting his elbow and going after the FIFA guy from behind, hitting him in the back of the head real hard with his elbow on purpose, out of outrage, like little children. Throwing a wobbly, just doing this temper tantrum, just oh I didn't win. And Argentinians play like that, so they complain and they get touched and they fall to the ground and they do all these things, and they do all these nasty tactics where, like, that player who got hit real hard by the Argentinian when they jumped up to get to try to head a ball that was in the air. And you could see him deliberately injuring the guy, and the guy had to be taken out of the game. And they were doing all these acts of violence in a very subtle way, because it's like little children, I'm going to win no matter what. So that's how he won, quote unquote, his stupid, worthless trophy. And he feels vindicated, but he really wasn't that good. You want to watch great players, go watch Eusebio, the Portuguese player. Go watch Ruud Gullit, the Dutch player, beautiful, marvelous player, or go watch Zico, the Brazilian player of years ago, or watch Michel Platini, the French Italian, well, French player of Italian descent, Michel Platini, marvelous player, just beautiful to watch, or Johan Cruyff. The Dutch player. I mean, those are great players. Messi is not anywhere close to them. He's not that good. He's not worth $60 million. So the fact that he's coming here being overpaid like that and overhyped is just a sign that we are on our way, America's on its way to becoming an Argentina. A third world, a third rate country. And because we never got out of our sand pit. And I think that's what this posting was to be about. And the fact that Rutherford B. Hayes was so concerned about Latin America, the guy that we were going to talk about, and that he had such a direct involvement with South America and Argentina in particular, that he disputed this war between this conflict between the two, and was such an impact, he was not just, you know, some diplomat mediator. He had such a deep impact that the people of Paraguay named a whole province after him. So there's an interconnection, and I think it goes beyond my understanding of how all of this is interrelated. Interrelated, just like Inter Miami, where Messi's going to be, or has just played. I believe this is what this recording was meant to be about, even though my intention was to talk about Hayes and certain things about his administration, his term, that we will get to, hopefully, in the next recording. We were meant to talk about the sandpit, the state of stagnation that we're in, that is reflected in the weather pattern, and how, as we are pummeled, we've lost our beauty, and we are going to be like Argentina, but ugly as Argentina, and go down in history as a nation of failure, of ultimate failure. Thank you very much for listening, and we will get to Rutherford B. Hayes in the next recording, hopefully. Thank you very much.